C2 Certificate in ESOL International All Modes Examination. Section 1. Listening. I am going to give you the instructions for this part of the test. You will hear this sound at the start of each piece. Remember to transfer your answers to the optical mark sheet before the end of the exam. Now, open your question paper and look at Part 1A. Listening, Part 1. Section A. Listen to the first section of a radio program about gambling addiction, in which the presenter, Ray Brooks, interviews Stephen, a gambling addict, and Dr. Liz Manning, an expert on gambling addiction. For questions 1 to 5, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C. You will hear section A twice. You have 1 minute to read the questions for section A.
These days, it seems many adults like to gamble, whether it's buying a weekly lottery ticket, betting on the latest football results, or even trying their luck in a casino and no harm done. However, an estimated 15 million people in the EU go further than that. They have a gambling problem. And sadly, some 4 million of those people are classified by psychologists as pathological gamblers. In other words, they're gambling addicts. Gambling addiction can lead to personal financial disaster and put severe stress on families. Dr. Manning, you're an expert on gambling addiction. Can you tell us about it?
Certainly, Ray. Gambling addiction is what's referred to as an impulse control disorder. Everybody has impulses, things they suddenly want to do. You get an overwhelming urge to eat chocolate when you walk past a vending machine. You see a fantastic pair of shoes in the shop window and you have to buy them. This is a perfectly normal pattern of behaviour. But most people also have impulse control. That is, they have enough self-discipline not to give in to impulses when it's inappropriate to do so. For example, if those shoes in the window cost 50 euros, it's probably not a huge problem if you buy them. But if the shoes cost a month's salary, mentally healthy people have enough control over their impulses not to buy them. In contrast, people with an impulse control disorder have lost the ability to say no. People with gambling addiction have specifically lost that self-control with regard to making bets. However, in other areas, they behave normally and exhibit the same control as anyone else, and this can mask the problem of their gambling addiction.
So they have the same impulses as the rest of us, having a bit of fun at the casino or betting on sports, but they don't have the capacity to control the intensity of these impulses.
Exactly.
Now, let's talk to someone who knows all about these problems from personal experience. Stephen, you were a successful computer programmer at the time you became addicted to gambling. You were married with 3 kids. Tell us what gambling addiction did to your life.
I think the most dreadful thing was that gambling changed me as a human being. Before gambling took hold, I always considered myself to be an honest person and a family man. But when my gambling got out of control, I became obsessive, thinking only of the next bet. I lied to my wife, I ignored my kids, and I even found myself stealing.
Stealing?
Sadly, yes. I threw aside all the conventions of family life. I stole from my parents, from my wife, and, really, I stole from my kids as well. I took money that we'd set aside for their education and poured it down the drain, gambling. That's one of the things that makes gambling addiction so awful. It doesn't just ruin the addict's life and moral character. It ruins the lives of everyone they're close to.
Oh, how tragic. Thank you for sharing that with us, Stephen. We'll be right back after a short break.
Now listen again.
These days, it seems many adults like to gamble, whether it's buying a weekly lottery ticket, betting on the latest football results, or even trying their luck in a casino and no harm done. However, an estimated 15 million people in the EU go further than that. They have a gambling problem. And sadly, some 4 million of those people are classified by psychologists as pathological gamblers. In other words, they're gambling addicts. Gambling addiction can lead to personal financial disaster and put severe stress on families. Dr. Manning, you're an expert on gambling addiction. Can you tell us about it?
Certainly, Ray. Gambling addiction is what's referred to as an impulse control disorder. Everybody has impulses, things they suddenly want to do. You get an overwhelming urge to eat chocolate when you walk past a vending machine. You see a fantastic pair of shoes in the shop window and you have to buy them. This is a perfectly normal pattern of behaviour. But most people also have impulse control. That is, they have enough self-discipline not to give in to impulses when it's inappropriate to do so. For example, if those shoes in the window cost 50 euros, it's probably not a huge problem if you buy them. But if the shoes cost a month's salary, mentally healthy people have enough control over their impulses not to buy them. In contrast, people with an impulse control disorder have lost the ability to say no. People with gambling addiction have specifically lost that self-control with regard to making bets. However, in other areas, they behave normally and exhibit the same control as anyone else, and this can mask the problem of their gambling addiction.
So they have the same impulses as the rest of us, having a bit of fun at the casino or betting on sports, but they don't have the capacity to control the intensity of these impulses.
Exactly.
Now, let's talk to someone who knows all about these problems from personal experience. Stephen, you were a successful computer programmer at the time you became addicted to gambling. You were married with three kids. Tell us what gambling addiction did to your life.
I think the most dreadful thing was that gambling changed me as a human being. Before gambling took hold, I always considered myself to be an honest person and a family man. But when my gambling got out of control, I became obsessive, thinking only of the next bet. I lied to my wife, I ignored my kids, and I even found myself stealing.
Stealing?
Sadly, yes. I threw aside all the conventions of family life. I stole from my parents, from my wife, and, really, I stole from my kids as well. I took money that we'd set aside for their education and poured it down the drain. Gambling. That's one of the things that makes gambling addiction so awful. It doesn't just ruin the addict's life and moral character. It ruins the lives of everyone they're close to.
Oh, how tragic. Thank you for sharing that with us, Stephen. We'll be right back after a short break.
That is the end of Part 1, Section A of the listening test. Now turn to Part 1, Section B. ESB Level 3, C2, Listening Part 1, Section B. Listen to the second section of a radio program about gambling addiction. For questions 6 to 10, choose the correct answer A, B, or C. You will hear section B twice. You have 1 minute to read the questions for section B.
Stephen, before the break, you told us about some of the negative effects gambling addiction had on you. Were these gambling impulses always present in your everyday life?
Yeah, in some ways. As I mentioned before, I was always thinking about gambling, always. But, on the other hand, there were some occasions where I felt I could control it and maybe even get things back to normal. Then there were other periods where I just lost it and did unbelievably stupid things.
That's a typical experience of people suffering from gambling addiction. Impulse control isn't an all-or-nothing situation. When people suffer from impulse control disorders, they can usually still manage a reasonable amount of self-discipline when they're feeling mentally strong.
So, as long as you're feeling good about life, things will be okay, and it's only when difficulties arise that the gambling addiction really strikes.
Yes, the loss of control will usually occur when the addict is mentally stressed, after a hard day at work, anxiety about something, a family argument, etc. It's at those times that they'll fail to control their more damaging impulses.
So, in a way, gambling addiction kicks you when you're down.
Very much so, yes.
So, Stephen, you are a recovered gambling addict. You no longer gamble, and you've managed to get your life back on track. What advice can you offer to others who have the same problems?
Well, we don't say recovered. We say recovering. Because it's not something that ever goes away. Once you're an addict for life. But, as for getting your life back, the most important thing is to seek help.
Don't you have to recognise that you have a problem in the first place?
Every gambling addict knows that they have a problem. When your credit card has been cancelled and the bank's about to repossess your house, you can't not know that you have a problem. But a lot of addicts have the idea that they can deal with these problems themselves. Often, ironically, by gambling more to try and make up their losses. I know from experience that you can't sort these things out on your own. You need a helping hand, and realising that is the start of your recovery.
And so, Dr. Manning, what help is available to gambling addicts?
Oh, quite a lot, actually, though, to be honest, the help is of mixed quality. There's Gamblers Anonymous, a charity which offers a traditional treatment programme that forces the addict to seek help and attempt to repair the damage their addiction has caused, and then learn to change their lifestyle. As a therapist, I have my doubts about some aspects of these programmes, but they are certainly better than trying to deal with the problem on your own. There are also new, very exciting cognitive approaches that focus on altering the way you think about gambling so as to change your problem behaviour. There are also older approaches like psychotherapy, associated with Sigmund Freud, of course. But as a modern therapist, I would hesitate to recommend this, as it's the least effective method of treating addiction.
Now listen again.
Stephen, Before the break, you told us about some of the negative effects gambling addiction had on you. Were these gambling impulses always present in your everyday life?
Yeah, in some ways. As I mentioned before, I was always thinking about gambling, always. But, on the other hand, there were some occasions where I felt I could control it and maybe even get things back to normal. Then there were other periods where I just lost it and did unbelievably stupid things.
That's a typical experience of people suffering from gambling addiction. Impulse control isn't an all-or-nothing situation. When people suffer from impulse control disorders, they can usually still manage a reasonable amount of self-discipline when they're feeling mentally strong.
So, as long as you're feeling good about life, things will be okay, and it's only when difficulties arise that the gambling addiction really strikes.
Yes, the loss of control will usually occur when the addict is mentally stressed, after a hard day at work, anxiety about something, a family argument, etc. It's at those times that they'll fail to control their more damaging impulses.
So, in a way, gambling addiction kicks you when you're down.
Very much so, yes.
So, Stephen, you are a recovered gambling addict. You no longer gamble, and you've managed to get your life back on track. What advice can you offer to others who have the same problems?
Well, we don't say recovered. We say recovering. Because it's not something that ever goes away. Once you're an addict for life. But as for getting your life back, the most important thing is to seek help.
Don't you have to recognise that you have a problem in the first place?
Every gambling addict knows that they have a problem. When your credit card has been cancelled and the bank's about to repossess your house, you can't not know that you have a problem. But a lot of addicts have the idea that they can deal with these problems themselves. Often, ironically, by gambling more to try and make up their losses. I know from experience that you can't sort these things out on your own. You need a helping hand, and realising that is the start of your recovery.
And so, Dr. Manning, what help is available to gambling addicts?
Quite a lot, actually, though, to be honest, the help is of mixed quality. There's Gamblers Anonymous, a charity which offers a traditional treatment programme that forces the addict to seek help and attempt to repair the damage their addiction has caused, and then learn to change their lifestyle. As a therapist, I have my doubts about some aspects of these programs, but they are certainly better than trying to deal with the problem on your own. There are also new, very exciting cognitive approaches that focus on altering the way you think about gambling so as to change your problem behavior. There are also older approaches like psychotherapy, associated with Sigmund Freud, of course. But as a modern therapist, I would hesitate to recommend this, as it's the least effective method of treating addiction.
That is the end of Part 1, Section B of the listening test. Now turn to Part 2. ESB Level 3, C2. Listening, Part 2. Listen to three conversations. For questions 11 to 20, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C. You will hear each conversation twice. You have 2 minutes to read the questions. Conversation 1.
Dr. Linus, I failed my first year marketing exam. What should I do?
Well, Carl, you need to take a re-sit exam, which is just like a regular exam, apart from the timing. It'll probably be some time in the summer, but I don't think the date has been finalised yet, but probably late August. You revise for it using all your notes, and then just turn up on the day.
I didn't really take notes for that class. Maybe I could borrow somebody else's notes for my revision.
Possibly, but it's often quite difficult for one student to follow another's notes. Everyone has their own personal style when it comes to note-taking, and that can make it quite difficult to interpret another student's notes. Also, there's no real guarantee that the notes you borrow will be any good.
I was going to get them off Sabina. She's a really excellent student. I'm sure her notes would be good.
Well, have you thought about making your own notes? You were in Professor Hammond's class, right? He puts all his lecture notes up on his website, together with the syllabus. I assume you've got the core textbook. That should give you enough to put together your own notes, which will be a lot more helpful in terms of preparing for the exam. Of course, you realise you can only get a maximum of 40% in a re-sit exam.
Yeah, but I don't really want to spend all that time studying if I can't get a decent grade. Is the 40% just for the re-sit or for the whole marketing course?
Unfortunately, you can only get a maximum of 40% for the course as a whole. But the knowledge you gain during your revision will stand you in good stead for your second year. And remember, your first year grades aren't incorporated into your final average. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't try hard.
Yeah, I guess so. It's just that I'm not into marketing. I can't really see the point of it. My aunt has a business, right? Well, I go and work for her in the vacation and it's all about sales with her. I'm not saying that marketing isn't important, but she has specialists to do that for her. She focuses on the face-to-face stuff, on negotiating and closing a deal. She's brilliant at it. That's the kind of business I want to do.
Well, Carl, maybe you should consider whether the academic path is the right one for you.
Now listen again.
Dr. Linus, I failed my first year marketing exam. What should I do?
Well, Carl, you need to take a re-sit exam, which is just like a regular exam, apart from the timing. It'll probably be some time in the summer, but I don't think the date has been finalised yet, but probably late August. You revise for it using all your notes, and then just turn up on the day.
I didn't really take notes for that class. Maybe I could borrow somebody else's notes for my revision.
Possibly, but it's often quite difficult for one student to follow another's notes. Everyone has their own personal style when it comes to note-taking, and that can make it quite difficult to interpret another student's notes. Also, there's no real guarantee that the notes you borrow will be any good.
I was going to get them off Sabina. She's a really excellent student. I'm sure her notes would be good.
Well, have you thought about making your own notes? You were in Professor Hammond's class, right? He puts all his lecture notes up on his website, together with the syllabus. I assume you've got the core textbook. That should give you enough to put together your own notes, which will be a lot more helpful in terms of preparing for the exam. Of course, you realise you can only get a maximum of 40% in a re-sit exam.
Yeah, but I don't really want to spend all that time studying if I can't get a decent grade. Is the 40% just for the re-sit or for the whole marketing course?
Unfortunately, you can only get a maximum of 40% for the course as a whole. But the knowledge you gain during your revision will stand you in good stead for your second year. And remember, your first year grades aren't incorporated into your final average. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't try hard.
Yeah, I guess so. It's just that I'm not into marketing. I can't really see the point of it. My aunt has a business, right? Well, I go and work for her in the vacation and it's all about sales with her. I'm not saying that marketing isn't important, but she has specialists to do that for her. She focuses on the face-to-face stuff, on negotiating and closing a deal. She's brilliant at it. That's the kind of business I want to do.
Well, Carl, Maybe you should consider whether the academic path is the right one for you.
Conversation 2.
Hey, Chris, what are you thinking about?
I still can't decide whether to buy a motorbike or not.
Do it!
Yeah, I'm leaning that way. I just got an earful from my mother, though. She's convinced I'm going to have some horrible accident if I get a motorbike.
Well, they are dangerous. You had a pretty bad motorbike accident once, didn't you, Paula?
Yeah, I got hit by a car 3 years ago.
What happened?
The driver didn't see me. I was riding my motorbike along the main road. He was waiting at a junction, but then he suddenly pulled out. I guess he wasn't paying attention, and he just came straight out in front of me. He wasn't going very fast, but it was so sudden I couldn't manage to swerve around him.
Were you hurt?
Yeah. I had a broken shoulder and concussion. I was in the hospital overnight, and I couldn't work for a week. And the bike was a write-off.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah, that's the big downside. There's lots of good stuff about motorbikes, though. They don't pump so much exhaust into the air. And it's cheaper, too. It's pretty good getting 100 kilometres to the litre.
Definitely. And you can actually feel the environment on a bike as well. That's something you don't even know you're missing in a car, don't you think, Jim?
Yeah, it's great to be able to smell the countryside around you and just feel the air on your face as you ride.
Yeah, I can definitely see the appeal of that. But what about when it's raining or freezing cold out?
Well, it is sometimes, but you can drive or take the bus if it's raining. Even if you only ride your bike 2 or 3 days a week, you'll really notice the difference.
Yeah, you'll just hate all the traffic when you get back in a car.
It's great to be able to weave in and out of traffic on a bike.
I don't know, Jim. I have to say, it bugs me as a driver when bikers do that.
Oh, it doesn't hurt anyone. You'll understand when you're a biker.
Can't see myself weaving in and out of traffic like that, though.
I bet in 6 months' time you'll be...
Now listen again.
Hey, Chris. What are you thinking about?
I still can't decide whether to buy a motorbike or not.
Do it!
Yeah, I'm leaning that way. I just got an earful from my mother, though. She's convinced I'm going to have some horrible accident if I get a motorbike.
Well, they are dangerous. You had a pretty bad motorbike accident once, didn't you, Paula?
Yeah, I got hit by a car 3 years ago.
What happened?
The driver didn't see me. I was riding my motorbike along the main road. He was waiting at a junction, but then he suddenly pulled out. I guess he wasn't paying attention, and he just came straight out in front of me. He wasn't going very fast, but it was so sudden I couldn't manage to swerve around him.
Were you hurt?
Yeah. I had a broken shoulder and concussion. I was in the hospital overnight, and I couldn't work for a week. And the bike was a write-off.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah, that's the big downside. There's lots of good stuff about motorbikes, though. They don't pump so much exhaust into the air. And it's cheaper, too. It's pretty good getting 100 kilometres to the litre.
Definitely. And you can actually feel the environment on a bike as well. That's something you don't even know you're missing in a car, don't you think, Jim?
Yeah, it's great to be able to smell the countryside around you and just feel the air on your face as you ride.
Yeah, I can definitely see the appeal of that. But what about when it's raining or freezing cold out?
Well, it is sometimes, but you can drive or take the bus if it's raining. Even if you only ride your bike 2 or 3 days a week, you'll really notice the difference.
Yeah, you'll just hate all the traffic when you get back in a car.
It's great to be able to weave in and out of traffic on a bike.
I don't know, Jim. I have to say, it bugs me as a driver when bikers do that.
Oh, it doesn't hurt anyone. You'll understand when you're a biker.
Can't see myself weaving in and out of traffic like that, though.
I bet in 6 months' time you'll be...
Conversation 3.
Hello, this is Global Bank. My name is Rachel. Can I have your name, please?
Yes, my name's Mark Weatherby.
Hello, Mr. Weatherby. Are you a Global Bank account holder?
Yes, I am.
Before we proceed, I need to ask you some security questions. Can I have your date of birth, please?
The 12th of the 2nd, 1955.
And your mother's maiden name?
Harrington.
Thank you, that's fine. And how can I help you today, Mr. Weatherby?
Well, I was withdrawing money from a cash point machine, and I asked for a mini statement, and then when I was checking it, I noticed a bank charge for £148, and I'm not really sure what it's for.
OK. Do you know the date of the charge?
Yes, I do. I've got the mini statement right here. It was 2 days ago, October 14th.
Yes, I can see that transaction on my screen now. That's not actually a bank charge. It's a debit card payment to JPC Groceries Online.
That's odd.
Do you buy groceries online from JPC?
Well, yes, we do, but I don't remember having ordered groceries on the 14th. Are you able to give me a few more details about the transaction?
I'm sorry. All we have access to is the amount and the company that debited the funds from your account. But if you have any suspicions, then it's probably a good idea to check a few more transactions, just to make sure that there hasn't been any fraud on the card.
What do you mean?
Well, if you didn't make the transaction, then there's the possibility that someone could be using your card to make purchases without your knowledge.
But I haven't given my bank details to anybody.
Unfortunately, sir, there are many ways that fraudsters can get hold of your details without you knowing about it. Would it be all right if I just ran a few recent transactions past you, so you can tell me if you made them or not?
You've got me worried now. Yes, go ahead.
I've got a transaction here for £63.14 on the 12th of October at UCAM Petrol Station.
Yes, that one's fine. I remember that.
And a transaction for £77 on October the 10th with Lane Breaks Online Betting.
Online betting? That's definitely not me.
Well, I'm sorry to say, Mr. Weatherby, that it looks as though your card is being used fraudulently. I'll cancel it and have a new one sent out to you immediately. I'll also need to send you a full statement so that you can check all the withdrawals and transactions for the last month. If you find any other discrepancies, then please let us know at once.
Oh, this is terrible. Am I covered against this?
I'm afraid this is an all too common problem, sir, but I can confirm that Global Bank fully covers you against all fraud and you won't be out of pocket.
Oh, thank goodness. That's really set my mind at rest.
Now listen again.
Hello, this is Global Bank. My name is Rachel. Can I have your name, please?
Yes, my name's Mark Weatherby.
Hello, Mr. Weatherby. Are you a Global Bank account holder?
Yes, I am.
Before we proceed, I need to ask you some security questions. Can I have your date of birth, please?
The 12th of the 2nd, 1955.
And your mother's maiden name?
Harrington.
Thank you, that's fine. And how can I help you today, Mr. Weatherby?
Well, I was withdrawing money from a cash point machine, and I asked for a mini statement, and then when I was checking it, I noticed a bank charge for £148, and I'm not really sure what it's for.
OK. Do you know the date of the charge?
Yes, I do. I've got the mini statement right here. It was 2 days ago, October 14th.
Yes, I can see that transaction on my screen now. That's not actually a bank charge. It's a debit card payment to JPC Groceries Online.
That's odd.
Do you buy groceries online from JPC?
Well, yes, we do, but I don't remember having ordered groceries on the 14th. Are you able to give me a few more details about the transaction?
I'm sorry. All we have access to is the amount and the company that debited the funds from your account. But if you have any suspicions, then it's probably a good idea to check a few more transactions, just to make sure that there hasn't been any fraud on the card.
What do you mean?
Well, if you didn't make the transaction, then there's the possibility that someone could be using your card to make purchases without your knowledge.
But I haven't given my bank details to anybody.
Unfortunately, sir, there are many ways that fraudsters can get hold of your details without you knowing about it. Would it be all right if I just ran a few recent transactions past you, so you can tell me if you made them or not?
You've got me worried now. Yes, go ahead.
I've got a transaction here for £63.14 on the 12th of October at UCAM Petrol Station.
Yes, that one's fine. I remember that.
And a transaction for £77 on October the 10th with Lane Breaks Online Betting.
Online betting?
That's definitely not me.
Well, I'm sorry to say, Mr. Weatherby, that it looks as though your card is being used fraudulently. I'll cancel it and have a new one sent out to you immediately. I'll also need to send you a full statement so that you can check all the withdrawals and transactions for the last month. If you find any other discrepancies, then please let us know at once.
Oh, this is terrible. Am I covered against this?
I'm afraid this is an all too common problem, sir, but I can confirm that Global Bank fully covers you against all fraud and you won't be out of pocket.
Oh, thank goodness. That's really sad.